From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Starting at midnight, recreational use of marijuana is legal in Canada.
You come over here and buy your pot and consume it. With the Americans, though, you cannot take it across the border.
At the same time, Canada and the U.S. have had no discussions about what problems this might cause for Canadian commuters.
No, we had not only just, you know, ignored the elephant in the room, the elephant died, and basically its rotting carcass is there, and we just pretended it wasn't happening.
Then we talked to a privacy scholar about how much of our data is being taken and sold.
In the United States, we don't have a general consumer privacy law.
We hear from another congressional candidate. This time, Debbie Dingell says she's considering supporting the trade agreement with Mexico and Canada that the Trump administration signed.
If the companies and the suppliers in the UAW think that this is better than the previous bill, then I will work for NAFTA.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Tomorrow, recreational use of marijuana becomes legal in Canada. Joining us to explain how that's going to work and what it might mean for Americans is Doug Schmidt with the Windsor Star. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Now, I understand the rules are different for each province. What are the main restrictions for buying pot in Ontario?
Well, we had a new government that was elected this past summer, and so they put the brakes on the previous plan, and the issue now is starting tonight at midnight, you can purchase recreational marijuana online in the province of Ontario, but in terms of bricks and mortar outlets where you can go and purchase, you know, show up in person and purchase your own pot, that's not going to happen until next spring. So that's the biggest difference, and that's sort of what Ontario is going to be doing different than other places.
What's the age limit?
19.
And I understand that once they start building brick-and-mortar outlets, it's going to be a lot like the beer store in Ontario, and you buy beer from the state. You'll be buying pot from the state as well, correct?
Well, when the bricks and mortar start, there's going to be a single distributor, which is the provincial government, but then these outlets are going to be private enterprise, but they have to purchase all the pot that they're going to be selling to the customer and clients must be sourced from the province.
Okay. So what are the local police in Windsor telling you about how they'll enforce the restrictions?
Local police, they're kind of like, at least in Windsor, very reluctant to enforce this. The rules are still being established. One of the biggest problems is driving under the influence, and there's no, you know, it's not like breathalyzers where you breathe into an apparatus and it says you have this much alcohol in your system. With pot, it's different. Pot gets taken up by the fat in the body, so it gets released over a longer time, but then there's that active period. So police say they're going to be looking for people like that, but in terms
harder to measure, though, right? Because there's not the equipment to do it right on the spot.
There is equipment, but
it's not reliable, let's put it that way.
They're not picking up on it because They say it's not incredibly accurate.
So does this mean someone from Michigan can cross the border and eventually go to a local weed dispensary and buy?
Eventually, yes. It's legal in Canada, so it'll be no different than tourists going to Amsterdam up until now. You can come over here and buy your pot and consume it. With the Americans, though, you cannot take it across the border.
I'm wondering if you consume it, how soon you should even try to cross the border, because that sounds like it could lead to a lot of problems, too.
Definitely. If you're under the influence, you're going to be in trouble. And, I mean, currently we've heard of Canadians who, you know, when they're crossing the border, if they get pulled aside for secondary inspection, they get follow-up questions. And one of the questions can be, have you ever consumed pot? And if you reply in the affirmative, even though, you know, it's maybe your college days decades ago, that could be grounds for you being prevented from crossing the border. So there's that.
Oh, sure. If you're a Canadian citizen, but not a U.S. citizen.
If you're an American, they can't prevent you from returning home. However, if you're one of those frequent flyers across the border who has a nexus permit, they can pull that out. They can withdraw that so that you can lose that status. I don't think it would affect a lot of people, but certainly anyone whose work takes them back and forth over the border regularly, they have those nexus permits, and you could lose that.
I'm wondering, this, you know, this sounds more and more like the days of Prohibition when Canada had alcohol and the U.S. didn't, and it seemed to find its way across the border. Are Canadian officials watching for some smuggling via midnight boats and so forth?
Canadians won't be, but the Americans sure would be.
You know, Michigan has a proposal on the ballot to legalize recreational use of marijuana. And if that passes, I assume there are a lot of the same issues because the border is controlled by the federal government and is still illegal according to the federal government. Do you think everyone understands that there's not going to be this free flow of pot back and forth?
I don't think it's fully understood that way. Coming this way, it shouldn't be an issue because, you know, federally we'll have it legal. But, yeah, there is that U.S. federal law that comes between the state and the province that will be an issue when it comes to travelers.
That's Doug Schmidt with the Windsor Star. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now that Canada is legalizing recreational use of marijuana, there are a lot of unanswered questions about Canadians crossing the border into the U.S. Joining me now is Canadian Member of Parliament Brian Massey. He represents Windsor in the House of Commons, and he's concerned that there's no agreement or policy or even a meeting between the two countries about this issue. Why do you think this might be a problem?
Well, you're going to have a number of individuals who will cross and potentially inadvertently have cannabis either, you know, residue or materials, paraphernalia, that could be accidentally in the vehicle. It could be old charges or old issues that may raise concerns or suspicions. So what I'm looking for is more of an adult conversation about what takes place. Today, there's breaking news about a Canadian soldier who served in Afghanistan, even with the U.S., who's detained in the U.S. He has a previous criminal conviction in which he was pardoned in Canada. He happened to be with somebody when they sold marijuana, basically for recreational use, to some undercover officer. He's been in the U.S. many times. He still is there right now. He's currently detained. We don't even know where he is, because he wants to get a green card, long story short, to marry one of your American citizens, and now he's been detained by your Border Patrol, and they can't even find where he is right now. So you have these kind of situations taking place, and they're one-offs are left to people figure out, and that's just not healthy for any of us.
So the big deal here, in my mind, is the number of commuters who go back and forth across the bridge or the tunnel from Windsor to Detroit for work. You know, if they, as you mentioned, happen to have a little debris in the car or perhaps even own shares in a marijuana company, are they at risk of a lifetime ban on travel to the U.S.?
So there was recently another statement by your country with the United States saying that if you have shares or investing, as long as it's not going over to the United States for business, then you should be fine. But the reality is we've seen some very different decisions made related to that have led to problems. And the issue that we have is about making sure that, you know, when mistakes take place, they're vetted. The reality is that, you know, I've met with your officials in Washington, and they're very clear, and I accept that the United States, this is a controlled substance. It is a drug similar to that consideration of cocaine, heroin, anything else crossing the border. But the reality is that we are going to have people inadvertently get caught up into this, and that can have very big significant consequences on our economy, on your tourism, on a number of different things. And so it's about an education process on the Canadian side to make sure that we weed out, no pun intended, all those accidental problems. But also, too, is having those conversations about previous, you know, people that may perhaps have, you know, done something when they were 16 or 17, and we have some of them. Say, for example, a truck driver who's never had a criminal record afterwards that now is now seen as a person of suspect or concern, who's delivering just-in-time materials for auto industry that make us both successful on both sides of the border, doesn't become a target and slow down our economic production because simply of a perceived or a practice that's so hard-lined it doesn't really deal with the reality is that they've had, you know, something when they were 17, but now when they're 50s and they have no criminal record, are part of our economy and making ourselves weak and compete with other countries.
The U.S. Customs and Border Protection is planning a news conference tomorrow about Canadian legalization of marijuana and what travelers from Canada should be aware of. What do you hope to hear in that news conference?
Well, I hope we hear rules that are very clear and going to be practiced on a very much a predictable level. I think that would be very helpful. The United States has every right to decide how it wants to deal with this and accept that. But if we want to really, frankly, be, you know, real about this, is that there's 10,000 Canadians that, you know, and Americans that go back and forth amongst our border for our economy, for us to be successful, not only just the Windsor-Detroit region, but also Sarnia, Fort Huron, and other places across Ontario and Michigan and New York, that we need good standard rules and models to be in place so that we can continue to be successful as economies. And also our families and our friends, it's what makes us so strong together, is this cultural and social and business involvement that happens on a personal level, not a political level. So I'm hoping what they're going to say is that these are the things that we're going to be looking for. These are things that are unacceptable, and do not even attempt to try that. If you do, these are the consequences. But at the same time, we don't see these other extreme cases like the one I'm mentioning right now, where a former Afghanistan veteran from the Canadian Forces can't even be found in the United States right now, who happened to be by somebody during a bust and has served with the United States.
Let me interrupt you, because I want to get to this last question while we still have time.
Yep.
Why hasn't this issue been brought up until now? I mean, it seems like during the negotiation of the USMCA or NAFTA 2.0, it might have been an opportunity time to work out some kind of agreement, because, I mean, tomorrow, pot is legal in Canada, and we have no ground rules.
Yeah, no, we had not only just, you know, ignored the elephant in the room, the elephant died, and basically its rotting carcass is there, and we just pretended it wasn't happening. And that's the reality that we're going to face with tomorrow, is that our both countries could have worked out some more procedural elements with regards to this, but we didn't. And that's one of the things I have a criticism of our current agreement that we're looking at with regards to trade and changing NAFTA, is that we didn't even deal with a whole bunch of issues related to the practical elements of the border. And I think many of us in our region understand that.
Canada's change in the law. Is it Canada's fault that this wasn't brought up?
I think there's a good part of responsibility on the Canadian government to do that. And I think it was our onus to continue to press upon that. And I think that the reality is that the U.S. is in a situation where many states are diverging from the federal government, and there's a tug of war with regards to power there, but that doesn't take away from our responsibility. So I would argue that the onus of the responsibility is on the Canadians, because we're changing that relationship. At the same time, there's been a lot of U.S. requests with more data, information, and other things on the border. Basically, it almost doesn't matter whose fault it really is. We both got to get our heads together around this, because if we make our border thicker and have more problems, then we're not going to be able to compete and we'll lose jobs.
Brian Massey is a member of Parliament in Canada. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll talk with Debbie Dingell, the incumbent Democrat from Michigan's 12th Congressional District, about her main priorities if reelected.
First of all, we need a major infrastructure bill that is not only going to improve our roads and our bridges, but we need to address the issue of net neutrality.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Detroit's central business districts have made major turnarounds in the last decade. Vacant apartment units have been renovated, and new construction has appeared in the fast-growing region. Some of those units were set aside for low-income residents, although through a federal tax credit program. But after 15 years, those tax credits expire. That means Detroit residents might soon face a shortage of affordable options as units flip to market rate. The city and some nonprofits have been working on a plan to preserve the city's existing affordable housing. Joining me to talk about that are Julie Schneider. She's with the City of Detroit's Housing and Revitalization Department, and Tahira Ziegler, who heads up the Local Initiative Support Corporation, or LISC. So, Julie, how many units are you trying to preserve? And of those, how many are multifamily and how many are single family?
So the city released a multifamily affordable housing strategy that focused on two goals: preserving 10,000 existing affordable housing units and developing another 2,000 new affordable housing units. So the 10,000 unit number represents about 8,800 units that are most at risk of losing their required affordability period between now and 2023, and about 1,200 units of naturally occurring affordable housing. We are also in the process of developing a single-family housing strategy that would be released probably later in 2019 that will get to how we preserve our single-family housing stock in the city of Detroit.
Tahira, how does LISC get involved in this?
Well, I think, you know, we've been in the city for 28 years really supporting and financing affordable housing for Detroit. So we're working with the city of Detroit and other partners to figure out how to keep units affordable so that it's not such a burden on households. Rental housing is increasing in terms of what we are seeing in the market. So you have a lot of households that have either transitioned from homeownership to rental. You're seeing more demand for rental housing in the market. And so how do we make sure that there are market rate housing units available? And then how do we put together a system and a process for making sure that housing units are staying affordable?
You know, I've heard this term affordable housing, and I know the formula, but at the same time, when I hear the rent amounts a lot of times for affordable housing, it seems pretty high. I mean, 70% of the households in Detroit range from low income to extremely low income. So what can they really afford for, let's say, a two-bedroom unit?
So the goals that we've set forth and the work that has been done in the city thus far, we've been developing housing at rates that are affordable at 80% of area median income lower. However, over 80% of the units that have been preserved or created since 2015 have actually been affordable to households earning 60% of area median income or lower. So that, for a single person, that looks like a rent of about $650 to $750, depending on whether or not utilities are included in that. So we've really been focusing on how do we serve not only households at 60%, but also at 40, 30%, making sure that we're working with our Detroit Housing Commission to identify rental assistance resources that we can make available to Detroit residents.
As you both have mentioned, Detroit has transitioned from a city of mostly homeowners to a city of mostly renters. This means you have to work with a lot of landlords to accomplish your goal of preserving affordable housing. How do you help them?
Well, I think the city's plan and their strategy to provide incentives to property owners to keep their properties affordable is one that's really needed in the market. I think that the way that we're thinking about supporting this work with the city is providing a menu, so to speak, of financial tools and resources to help keep these units affordable.
Tahira, when you say those economic tools, are you talking about low-interest loans? Are you talking about grants? And what are they to do with those once they get that money?
Sure, we're talking about all of that. We're creating products right now with the city to offer to property owners in terms of what is available for their particular property. It's going to be very customized to the property. It's going to be customized to the income constraints and the way that we're trying to figure out who will be prioritized in the process. But there will be several kinds of products, low interest loans. There will be obviously some public subsidies included and some grants that will be included to kind of come up with some products that will work for the Detroit market.
Part of preserving these housing units is making sure that they're up to code, that they have improvements that they need. But once that's done, how do you ensure that the landlord doesn't jack up the rent to market rates?
Well, Lester, the loan types and the grant types that Tahira is referring to all come with long-term affordability restrictions. So those requirements make it so that affordable housing developers will have to report on incomes, who is being served within those units for quite a long time. It's something that we have to make sure that we're not only making the housing affordable to households, but we're making sure that the people living in it are the people that those units are meant to provide affordable housing for.
I was reading a city report, and for all I know, Julie, you might have written this. It indicated federal funding to support affordable housing has declined steeply, and of course, low-income housing tax credits are expiring. With those kinds of incentives and assistance disappearing, where do you find the money to preserve these affordable housing units?
as you've stated, the resources available to develop affordable housing has been decreasing over quite some time now. And so we have these affordable housing units, many of which are located in areas of the city where rents are rising the fastest, and it's so critical that we preserve them. So the Affordable Housing Leverage Fund is meant to address that gap that has been created over decreasing federal funding for the last 20 years.
So if you all do preserve these, as I understand it, 10,000 existing units and another 2,000 new units in neighborhoods across the city, how close do you actually come to meeting the need for affordable housing in Detroit?
So we know the potential risk of not preserving is great. That's why we've been working as an administration to really tackle that need. So a part of the purpose of preserving and creating the 12,000 units is to make sure that we're acting proactively so that the 10,000 households that are in these units now are not being displaced, and that in 10 years somebody is able to find affordable housing in those units in the future. We have to continue creating more, and we have to make sure that we are developing single-family programs that help to create and sustain affordable housing in the city and throughout neighborhoods.
Tahira Ziegler is Executive Director of LISC Detroit, and Julie Schneider is Associate Director for Policy and Implementation in the City of Detroit's Housing and Revitalization Department. Thanks very much to both of you. Thank you for having us. We are interviewing congressional candidates from around the state as we get closer to Election Day. Today we're talking with Michigan's 12th District incumbent, Democrat Debbie Dingell. Welcome back to Stateside.
It is always good to be at Stateside.
When you first ran for office, you told me you wanted to reach across the aisle to build bipartisanship. And while home in Michigan, you've worked with Republican Representatives Fred Upton and Tim Walberg, at least those are the ones I know about. How often does that translate into working together in the Capitol?
Well, I think that, Fred and I have been, and actually Tim too. It's not exactly what I would have asked for, but on the other hand, we got him here. So, for instance, when we just had a hearing on PFAS, and I had dealt with, Laura and I had talked as well as the LCV, and EPA was not coming.
You mean Laura Rubin?
Laura Rubin, correct. River Watershed Council, that EPA wasn't coming to Michigan. So during that hearing, I asked EPA why they weren't coming, and they said, well, they'd come if they were wanted. And I said, Fred, Tim, we want them, don't we? Absolutely. So I would have preferred a larger public forum, but we got them here, and we started to tell the story. And Fred and I will be, and Tim, will all be pushing very hard to get PFAS legislation either yet this year, or we'll be reintroducing and working very hard at the beginning of next year.
So it sounds like bipartisanship in Michigan is not dead.
It's not dead. I wish it, but Fred and I have done red flag legislation on guns, which has gotten people madder at me than it's gotten madder at him. But you got to keep working together, and it takes a while sometimes to get things done. But if you don't respect each other, if you don't listen to each other, you're not going to get things done.
You're running in a district that voted for Trump, although by a very slim margin. And you said at the time you'd work with President Trump on anything that helps the working men and women of your district. How's that going?
Well, one of the issues that I think is up in the air right now is the NAFTA 2.0 that he just reached agreement on in the last couple of weeks with both Canada and Mexico. Devil's in the details. I'm talking to the autos, to the suppliers, and to the UAW. But if it will, the first NAFTA, NAFTA 0.1, really hurt the working men and women of not only this district but in Michigan. And if this will help create more jobs, if the companies and the suppliers and the UAW think that this is better than the previous bill, then I will work for NAFTA.
How hard is that to sort out when you're already dealing with steel and aluminum tariffs?
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you something. People say that to me, but I want you to come down to the Down Rivers and to look at the McLaws steel plant that's been sitting on our rivers for 25 years empty. And I talk to everybody, and I don't want to increase consumer costs, but we need to have a government that'll fight for everybody the way some other countries' governments do. So trade's complicated. I spend a lot of time talking to everybody about it, but I understand the issue. I don't agree with the way that President Trump has done this in many ways. He does it in a very chaotic process. He doesn't reach out right away. You're not quite sure what he's up to. For him, it's the art of the deal. For me, it's jobs and making sure consumers have good quality product that they're not paying an arm and a leg for.
What do you see as the most important thing you've done during this most recent term in office?
You know, there are a lot of issues, some of them very personal. The environmental issues that we've all worked together on to ensure that we're protecting the Great Lakes. I think working and fighting very hard for a national standard on PFAS, I think it's the next great danger. I'm a very strong believer that every American's got a right to quality, affordable health care. We have kept the administration from totally destroying this bill. Healthcare will be the number one issue that comes back in the next Congress. I would like to think that Democrats will be in control, but even if it's not, we all have to do something about making drugs more affordable. We've been working on that, opioid drugs. There are a lot of subjects that really matter to me.
What problems in your district have been the most difficult to solve?
I think the environmental issues for this district continue to be a challenge. We have to make sure we're protecting the Great Lakes and that everybody's got clean water to drink, but that's much more complicated than people realize. How are we going to fix our infrastructure? But the plume in
the one for a dioxin,
the Gelman plume is something that worries many people. I'm very proud of the fact that I finally got, after almost 50 years, EPA to assign a full-time person to this issue. But the McLaws steel site has been sitting there empty for 25 years. We need to redevelop that site. It will shortly be put on the Superfund list. These are tough problems, and they're going to take time to clean them up. But you can't give up. You got to fight. You got to fight to keep our air clean, the water safe to drink, and to clean up sites that have been damaged by people in the past.
Okay, you've mentioned healthcare, jobs, and environment. What are your other priorities for another term in office?
Well, I think, first of all, we need a major infrastructure bill that is not only going to improve our roads and our bridges, but we need to address the issue of net neutrality, which will be one of the first issues if Democrats take over that will be addressed. We need to make sure that everybody's got access to broadband. We need to repair pipes, and we need to ensure that the electric grid is safe. So that's one issue that is critical. We need to address ethics and financial. We need to clean up the political funding and bring transparency to how money is being spent. Campaign finance reform needs to pass. We need to, on the revolving door, we need to clean it up once and for all. So there are those are some of the issues. Healthcare remains my number one issue. And protecting Social Security and Medicare.
Your Republican opponent, Jeff Jones, is running against you for the second time. In 2016, he got less than 100,000 votes, while you got more than 200,000 votes. He thinks he can clinch it this time because he's against what he calls dynasty politics, among other things. What do you think of that term, dynasty?
I am Debbie Dingell, and I am accountable to the people of the 12th District, and I have an appraisal every 2 years. And that's what an election's about. And I work very hard. I'm Debbie. And I try to go to as many events. I try to hear what's on people's minds, and I try to work hard for them. And I'm accountable to the working people, to all people in the 12th District of Michigan.
But when you see somebody named Levin or somebody named Dingell that's in a district for a long, long time, that seems to bother people because first thing they say is career politician. There is a negative connotation there.
So there is a negative connotation, but I think that the people of 12th District want to make sure that they've got a voice at the table. And by the way, I worked for General Motors for more than three decades. I have my own professional career. I was one of the first working women. I know what it's like to be a working woman and be the only woman in the room. I have too many stories to tell. But I'm Debbie. I'm not anybody else. And it's my performance that I'm accountable to the people of the 12th District for.
After the next census, it appears Michigan will lose yet another seat in Congress. I mean, that leaves the state with 13 members. That's down from a high of 19 members. What's that smaller representation going to mean for the state?
It means we've got to be smart. We're going to have to work harder. We're going to have to work together. We're going to have to work across the aisle. I put Michigan first before I ever do any party politics. And that's what we're going to have to do, is to be smart in how we work together to fight for this state.
Debbie Dingell is a member of Congress from Michigan's 12th Congressional District. She's a Democrat running for re-election. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's nearly impossible to spend time on the internet without websites and apps collecting information on everything from your political leanings to your shopping habits. Why? One word. Money.
Lots of these business models are built on the fact that people don't know what data is collected about them and how it is used.
Designing better privacy protections for the digital age. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. It was 1823. The land of Michigan wasn't yet a state. The indigenous people far outnumbered white settlers. The Erie Canal hadn't opened yet. The flood of European immigrants was yet to arrive. But the groundwork for their arrival was set in 1823 by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case about property rights. For the second story in our series, An Idea on the Land, Dustin Dwyer tells us about Johnson versus McIntosh.
On the fourth floor of the Michigan State University Law School building, on a windowsill that overlooks the campus, Winona Singel keeps her family photos. Singel is a law professor here and associate director of MSU's Indigenous Law and Policy Center. Family is the reason she went to law school, she says. When she was young, she was separated from her sister in what she says was a coerced adoption. It's a familiar story in many Native families.
And it's something that I wanted to understand more deeply. And in my mind, understanding the operation of our legal system and the development of federal Indian law and policy was absolutely critical.
So when she got older, she went to law school at Harvard. In the first year, all Harvard law students had to take a class on property law. That is where Winona Singel first heard of the landmark case known as Johnson v. McIntosh.
The original Johnson of the case was actually a former Supreme Court justice and a wealthy shareholder in the Illinois and Wabash Land Company. And this land company had speculated in the purchase of Indian lands.
It purchased those lands directly from the tribes. And at that same time, the federal government was out trying to get land from tribes. It negotiated treaties with the tribes. And once the government got the land, it would parcel it out to sell to settlers. So along comes this settler named McIntosh. He buys from the government. But the land he buys, it's already been bought by the Illinois and Wabash Land Company. Remember, that's the group of wealthy investors that buys directly from the tribes, and Johnson is a part of that group. So Johnson bought from the tribe. McIntosh bought from the U.S. government. The question before the Supreme Court, who really owned the land now? Johnson or McIntosh? It's an easy question if you think the tribe owned its land in the first place. Because if the tribe owned it, it could sell it to the Illinois and Wabash Land Company, Johnson's group. Johnson wins. But the real question was whether the tribe owned the land in the first place. Did they even have the power to sell it?
And to the surprise of the lawyers and shareholders in the Illinois and Wabash Land Company, Justice Marshall in the Johnson v. McIntosh case declared that the tribes did not have this power, and that they only had the power to transfer their property directly to the federal government.
McIntosh won the case because he had bought from the federal government, and Justice Marshall argued the federal government was the true owner of the land all along. The indigenous people of the U.S. had some rights on their land. They had the right to use it and occupy it, but they couldn't sell it on the open market because they didn't really own it. Yes, the U.S. government said Native people did not actually own the land they'd lived on for thousands of years. And yes, this decision had a huge impact. If and when Native people ever did want to sell their land rights, there was only one buyer they could turn to. That meant the buyer had the upper hand in the negotiations over price. It was a rigged deal. Single learned all this as a busy, stressed first-year law student.
And then you move on to the next case. And there's no further discussion about the wrong that this perpetuates, and also the flawed reasoning, and also fundamentally misinformed and racist presumptions that our property legal system is based upon.
And this isn't some obscure case. It's foundational in the U.S. legal system. Most law schools teach it to all their students in the first year.
In many ways, it's almost like gaslighting. You're learning about certain rights that are associated with property rights, the right of possession, the right to exclude, the right to transfer, knowing all along that these rights have not been respected and were not enforced for your own ancestors.
One of the passages in the actual text of the Supreme Court decision reads like this, quote, "The tribes of Indians inhabiting this country were fierce savages whose occupation was war and whose subsistence was drawn chiefly from the forest. To leave them in possession of their country was to leave the country a wilderness," end quote. This language and the precedent it established has never been overturned in America's legal system. It is valid law today.
Imagine if Plessy v. Ferguson was never overturned. Imagine if Dred Scott was never overturned, right? We've never had any kind of accounting and justice that has restored those original property rights.
After Johnson v. McIntosh, the early white settlers of Michigan drafted a series of treaties with the Native people of the area. These documents would have the tribes sign their land over to the federal government. Lewis Cass was Michigan's second governor. He negotiated a number of the treaties. In the late 1820s, he advocated for the forced removal of the land's Native people. In his argument, he echoed the words of Justice Marshall. He claimed if white people didn't rule the land, Michigan would be doomed to, quote, perpetual unproductiveness, end quote. Cass didn't get his wish for removal, but he did eventually get the treaties, and the white people did make the land productive in their way, the same as they had done in all of the Americas, says Willie Jennings of Yale Divinity School. They did what they believed their God wanted them to do.
The way they looked at the land from the very beginning, from Michigan to Maine, from Virginia to Florida, they looked at the land as the world in potential that needed development. And that development was always tied to what can be taken from the land.
In Michigan, a land of dense ancient forests, they could take a lot.
That was Dustin Dwyer. Tomorrow he'll continue his series, An Idea on the Land, with part three, The Story of Trees. When you're downloading software on your computer or an app for your phone, how often do you actually read the privacy policy that you're agreeing to when you click on I agree? Now, if you're like me and most other people, you don't bother. You just want the thing to work. If you're at all concerned about your privacy, that could end up being a real problem. Joining me now is privacy scholar Florian Schaub, who is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So when we hear data breaches, which seems to be a few times a month these days, we get concerned, but they're happening so often, it's kind of happening and we're just like, it's not affected me yet. nobody's stolen my identity, so I'm not going to worry about it. Are we just being too easy when we're offering all this information up?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of questions in there, right? So first, yes, we see lots of these data breaches, and you get letters in the mail, oh, you've been involved in this data breach. And the impulse for many people is to just ignore it. But that can be a really bad impulse, because recovering from someone actually stealing your identity and using your identity to procure new credit cards or new phones or other things, it's really expensive and time-consuming to recover from that, whereas taking some precautionary measures is actually not that hard.
I want to get to the precautionary measures you're talking about, both for the companies and for us, but you cited in one of your articles a 2008 study which estimated it would take 244 hours a year for the typical American internet user to read all the privacy policy for all the websites that they visited, and that was in 2008. I mean, that's before we started downloading a lot of apps on our phones. I'm just wondering, how are we supposed to navigate all of that when it's being thrown at us at every visit?
Yeah, I think you can't reasonably read all the privacy policies that you encounter, right? Like, as you said, that was 2008. Now we have smartphones, we have smart thermostats, we have cars that collect information and share information. So it's impossible to read all these privacy policies. At the same time, when you use a service, it is seen as consent with that privacy policy. So you're agreeing to that privacy policy. And one of the underlying problems is that in the United States, we don't have a general consumer privacy law at the moment. So we have very specific laws like HIPAA for protecting the privacy of health information or COPPA for protecting children online. But in general, as long as companies are transparent about what they're doing with your data, that means they write it down in a privacy policy.
That we don't read.
Yeah. There's very little that kind of limits what they can do, except for the Federal Trade Commission, who then, when their consumer complaints, checks these privacy policies and makes sure there's nothing deceptive or unfair.
So you suggest these should be more transparent or at least easier to understand, and they should be giving us some options. So what are you thinking about?
Yeah, so I think what's important to actually inform people and not just claim they agree to a privacy policy is we need to better integrate privacy information into how people interact with technology. It's not realistic that people read a multi-page statement before they sign up for Facebook or something else. But it's also not really what you need. It's not like Facebook is collecting all of the information at the moment when you sign up. It's stuff that happens when you're actually using the service. So having shorter notices that are actually presented when a certain data collection starts for the first time and then giving you a simple choice, yes, no, would be a way forward. And we're actually seeing this on smartphones. So if you have a current smartphone, you often get these pop-up messages. This app wants to access your location. This app wants to access your contacts.
Which is nice because, you know, at least you're not blanket giving it away. But at the same time, those are a nuisance, especially if you're on the road and your GPS or something pops up something. And then a lot of these other things you're talking about, like, you know, do you want to give us access about your location? Might want to do that for my GPS, but I might not want to do that for most of the other things. So if you're talking about getting permission more often, could that just turn into a nightmare for the user?
Yeah, I don't think the goal is to get permission more often. It is to make these permissions more fine-grained, right? So when I open Google Maps, for example, or Apple Maps, doesn't matter, right? I kind of expect that it will use my location. So if I see a pop-up, hey, is it okay for this app to use your location? I can easily say yes. If the same app is asking me for access to my text messages or my contacts, right? Like I can make a judgment in this situation and say like, I don't see a reason why this map app needs to have that data, and I can say no. And what we're actually seeing is that consumers are saying no to unreasonable requests. And as a result, mobile developers are putting much more care into kind of prefacing these permission dialogues with information, what they're actually going to be doing with that data, why are they collecting it, and what it's used for. And I think that's a good way towards more of a dialogue between the company and the consumer to say, like, this is okay, this is not okay. If you don't allow us to use this information, then we can't give you this particular service, but you can still use other features.
Which the bigger companies, the smarter companies are doing, but there are a lot of companies who are still saying, you either say yes or you get no access at all, and that's it. So is that going to change over the next several years?
I don't have a crystal ball. I think it should change. So one of the big problems is that, as I said earlier, in the US, we don't have a general privacy law that limits what companies can do with data. So I think what we really need is more reasonable limits on how personal data can be used. And if we look to Europe, which this year a new privacy law came into effect, the General Data Protection Regulation, it's a much more stringent but also more reasonable protection framework that basically says any kind of data collection is prohibited unless there are specific legal reasons for which you need that data. And that provides stronger protections for consumers. And the ironic thing is that American companies who are doing business in Europe actually have to follow this law. So Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Apple, all these companies are following the European privacy laws already, but it's really at their mercy whether they make those stronger protections also available to US consumers.
But there's money in data. And I can only imagine a lot of these software companies are going to be fighting this. I mean, they might have to adjust because of public pressure, but they certainly don't want government regulation to tell them, you can't make money on this data you've gathered. Where's the balance?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of points there. So on the one hand, yes, companies want to make money, and I think no one is saying companies shouldn't be making money. But I don't think it's fair or a good way how we do it at the moment, where basically lots of these business models are built on the fact that people don't know what data is collected about them and how it is used, right? Like whenever you go to a website, there are probably 15 to 20 advertising trackers on that website recording that you looked at this particular article. The websites often don't even know which trackers are active on their website because they sell that space out. A lot of this kind of happens in the dark. And I think what we need to do is we need to bring this more in the forefront, right? Like, this is our business model. This is how we make money. Are you okay with this particular use of your data? Yes and no. So that's kind of what I think should happen. In terms of the companies, there's also this aspect that companies are not necessarily opposed to regulation because it might create a clearer target for them to work towards in terms of what are the protections that are required, what is okay. Whereas right now, there's no consistent standard across industries.
And sure, it's a wild west out there.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, many US companies are already complying to European law, which is much stricter in terms of privacy. So it's not like it would cost them a lot of money to actually implement these protections.
I think the most serious data breach that we've heard about in recent years is the Equifax breach. And that's really serious because we're talking about our credit ratings then, which can affect everything in our life. So how does that happen to begin with, and how can we help ourselves not let something like that happen?
Yeah, so the Equifax breach last year was a huge breach affecting hundreds of millions of US consumers. And the big problem with that particular breach is that you don't have to be a customer of Equifax to be involved in this, right? Like, Equifax keeps credit records of you whether you want that or don't want that. And part of the information that was released is names, social security numbers, date of birth, right? All the ingredients you need for stealing someone's identity and misusing it. We conducted a study where we actually talked with people to see how they reacted to that data breach. And what we found quite surprisingly is that many people did not react at all. So we tried to analyze why is that the reason. And while there are things like optimism bias, people underestimating the chance that they're actually affected by this.
Even though we knew hundreds of millions of people were affected.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, they think, why would my record be used for identity theft? Or we had people who said, well, I don't have that much money and my credit rating is already low. What would people want with my data? The problem is identity thieves don't really work like that, right? Like, they don't do extensive research to figure out, like, oh, are you a juicy target or not? They just want a valid identity they can use to go off and procure some kind of service for themselves. So one way, the most effective way of actually protecting yourself against data breaches is to freeze your credit. The occasions where you really need someone to check your credit are very rare. You buy a new house, maybe you sign up for a new cable provider, right? New credit card. Like, it's things that happen maybe once a year, maybe every other year. So in the meantime, there's no reason for your credit file to be accessible. And in September, a new federal law came into effect that makes credit freezes free, which means anyone can now go place a credit freeze and have their data secured, and unfreezing them when they actually need someone to look up their credit is also relatively easy. Now, what's important for this to be effective is you not just need to do that at Equifax, you have to do it at all three major credit bureaus. So Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. If you just do it at one, yes, you're partially protected, but you're not fully protected. So you need to make sure you really do it at all three.
Now, I read that you're working with something called the Usable Privacy Project. I think we've talked about some of the elements that have come out of that project. What exactly is the goal there?
Yeah, so the Usable Privacy Policy Project is a collaboration among the Carnegie Mellon University, the University of Michigan, and Fordham University. And it's an interdisciplinary project to get to a place where we can provide more reasonable privacy information to people and make it easier for them to really have choices and have be in control of their privacy. So we've been working extensively on analyzing privacy policies, partially with machine learning and crowdsourcing to extract relevant information, make this available in better interfaces, and at the same time providing best practices to industry in how you can present privacy information to users in a way that's useful, but also actionable, so that people actually want to read it and can do something with that information, and in a way that's not annoying, but rather integrated into the interaction with the technology.
Florian Schaub is an assistant professor of information and an assistant professor of electrical engineering and computer science at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's all we've got for you today. The show was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.